Continue our survey of arguments. Yesterday we discussed the argument against the speculative process of negation, against the rejection of the positive characteristics. Oh, we discussed this last one yesterday, against the denial of activity and desire, that is to say, of life. Prabhupada says activity is the symptom of spirit. So how can spirit in itself be inactive? Then I mentioned to you some of the pitfalls of a logical argument. That is to say, you start with premises, and anybody can reject the argument if they can reject one of these premises. And this has a premise that some people would find easy to reject. That is to say that activity comes from, in the material world, we see that activity comes from the presence of spirit, because some people will say, well, you know, there's thunder, lightning, rain, water falls, all this activity, and we don't see any persons. So you have to be careful about using this argument. In other words, don't really use it with people who accept spirit, because your reply will be, well, they're demigods, you know, causing these things to happen. There are persons, but you have to be careful. In other words, you wouldn't use it against on a material scientist. Maybe a Mayavadi who already accepted something like spirit, you know, was already open to the other possibilities. But that's a limitation of that particular line of reasoning. So a fourth argument that I have listed here is against the limiting or diminishing the supreme. The Mayavad position, we claim, makes God less than us. This is one of Srila Prabhupada's arguments. I can have a girlfriend, why can't God? And so on. I have hands and legs, why can't God? I can do so many things, why can't God? Why does he have to be less than us? So our position is that the Mayavadi position actually limits or restricts God in so many different ways. While they say, profess to be trying to get the idea of someone that's great, and so on, that as a matter of fact, what they really do is limit him. Okay, that's the argument. Or another version of this, another variation of this, is that this neti, 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 neti makes God into a nothing, just a big zero, which is the most limited thing of all. And that's what they've actually done. He's the supreme, he's the greatest. How they ended up with nothing or very little. So they limit God. And here you make it personal. Number five. You charge them with envying God. This kind of follows from this one. You make yourself greater than God. Is what you do. That all your negations are actually criticisms. He's deaf, he's dumb, he's blind, he's lame. This is Prabhupada again.
What was the first thing you said? You're actually trying to be God?
You're greater. You're making yourself greater. You can do so many things that God can't do. That means you think you're greater than God. Actually, you're envious of God, and you're trying to reduce him down to something less than yourself, or less than zero. And that your negations are just criticisms. He's deaf, dumb, blind, lame. So on. So this shows an actual hostility to the Supreme. All right, so that's another tactic to take. Okay? That one's clear enough, right? Simple enough. So next one is, this is not so much, this is an argument on the principle that causes are superior. This is not against their position. Now, this is our position. You know, this is you cannot give what you haven't got argument. And whatever's in the effect is in the cause. And if you see variety, name, and form in here, it means it must be there. And in here you have the, yeah. One time when Prabhupada was praised, somebody was praising the beautiful sunset set to Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, "Yes, but consider how much more beautiful is that from which it comes. If you see beautiful things in the material world, that means the source must be even more beautiful." And so on. So all over the place, this principle is appealed to. You cannot give what you haven't got. That's my wording of that, you know. But that's the general idea. So that there are persons here, and so on. What you see, variety, name, form, and so on. It must be there in the Supreme. So this has a variation, number 7, which is an argument from correspondence or resemblance. Correspondence, resemblance, or inheritance, actually. This is that we are small samples of God, right? Or as Prabhupada says, you can understand God by studying us. We have form, that means God has form. Prabhupada quotes the Bible, man is made in the image of God. This is in the beginning of prayers to the personified Vedas, he says. It is said, he doesn't say it's the Bible, he just says, it is said. We are made in the image of God. Therefore we have form, therefore God has form. The son resembles his father. We are sons of God. Therefore, we have senses. God has senses. We discussed earlier, you can really elaborate this argument quite a bit. Now, people will say, you see, the claim is made when they see Krishna in a human form. There's a word for this, right? Imagining God in the form of a human being. Anthropomorphism, right? It's a big, big sin. You're not supposed to be anthropomorphic or impose your ideas of human beings. Anthro means human. Anthropomorphic, God, to imagine that God is in the form of a human being, right? So, using this argument, we say, no, it's not that God's form is anthropomorphic, but ours is theomorphic. I made up this word. Maybe it's around somewhere else. I don't know. But theos is the word for God. Theos, Greek word for God. Hotheos. Theomorphic. We're made in the image of God, so we're theomorphic. Anthropos is man. Anthropomorphic. So. Anthropos. Don't ask me to spell. Anthro. Morphic. I think that's how it goes. Yeah. The Greek word is anthropos. Right. Scott. Anyway. Okay, so this is the theomorphic argument here. We are made in the image of God. So it's not that no God is anthropomorphic, we're theomorphic. Well, that one, the anthropomorphic thing, or just a notion, it's just an argument, not particularly defeat anything, but just on the principle, from the superiority of cause to the appeal to the principle of correspondence, that the first five I gave were particularly against doctrines of theirs. Now we're just going on our own principles. From the superiority of cause, an argument from correspondence or resemblance or inheritance. We're small samples of God. So we're theomorphic. And that can be used against the anthropomorphic idea, which is a common one that everybody has. Well, this is anthropomorphic. They learned that word somewhere, you know, in Sunday school or something. So this is anthropomorphic. And they say, no, you're theomorphic. What can they say, you know? Stops them in their tracks. They never. And that word theomorphic, it has the same authority. Sounds like somebody, you know, who knew Greek made it up, you know, so it's a good one to use. Yeah? Did you have a question? Somebody did? Yeah.
The Christian mystics specifically wanted to make the case that the cause must not have what the result has.
No, not the Christian mystics. Plotinus. Yeah, Plotinus goes against this. I'll have to really get into Plotinus some more and try to figure out exactly, you know, how he gets away with it and who's picked up on it. I'm sure there's a literature on this somewhere. I just haven't gotten into it. He doesn't ever specifically speak against it. It's just sort of assumed all through his works. It's just sort of assumed. His assumption is that if you want to explain the existence of form, then you have to give as an explanatory principle something that doesn't have form. Because if it has form, then you have to explain the existence of that form. But again, you see, there's an assumption there that obviously something like eternal form is not acceptable. But as long as it's particular and concrete, that you can have some definite idea about it, it has to be temporary. Once you say form, you see, immediately, that's a limited thing. You know, form is limited. So therefore, because it's limited, it depends upon other things for its existence. And therefore, it can't be the ultimate. So there's some kind of reasoning like that going on in his mind, which he doesn't state. Always, you find everywhere, biggest philosophers, they never actually put all their cards on the table. You know? And you got to figure out, you know, what their unstated assumptions are. So it's something like that's going on in Plotinus. But we've already talked about this idea that eternal form is there. Okay? But the Christians don't, the Christian mystics don't tend to explicitly make that sort of argument. No, they're not going to say. There's only one place that I know of that Plotinus actually defends the position, where he just says magisterially, you do not have to give. You have what you give. He just says that.
Can you give the example of the soul giving form about things that it doesn't have to creatures that have being?
Yeah, he uses that, but they get that from the intelligence. The soul gets that from the intelligence. So it just passes it down. But you know, he uses the one cannot be a being because it is the source of beings. He said, once you're the source of beings, you can't be a being. Well, why not? You have to ask yourself that. Why not? Well, then the existence of being, the condition of the abstract condition of being an individual isn't explained. If you say, well, what if there's an eternal being? Well, no, it's a being. It's limited. If it's limited, that means it's contingent. It must depend upon other things for its existence. You know, therefore, there must be something higher to explain it. And so you have to go on to this indeterminate, you know, one. Something like that's going on with Plotinus. Let me keep going here. Well, that's our argument from correspondence and the theomorphic argument. Oh, now I'm going to go back against... this is against an argument against a Mayavadi position. This is how we defend ourselves. This is against their idea of that, say, person... I have to put these into codes, won't I? Etc. Is limitation. Now they'll say, God is not a person, God is not a being, God is not an individual, because that would limit him. Right? This is where you see Tillich gets into this one a whole lot. Because if God is an individual, then he's part of a whole which is greater than him. You don't remember, that's what he says. Putting it a little simpler than he puts it. But if God is a being among all beings, then he's part of a system, you know, a whole which is greater than God. Then there's something greater than God. Namely, God and the universe, or God and the whole. And he comes under all the categories which govern the whole. That's Tillich's part of his argument anyway. Our answer to this version of this person is a limitation, because there's several answers to this, because there's several versions, is that, no, Krishna includes the whole and transcends it at the same time. Nothing is different from Krishna, but Krishna is different from everything. He's both a being as well as being itself. You know, that's the way, at least that particular... That's a little more sophisticated objection than you usually hear. But there's just a notion that to be a person is a limitation. You know, people will just say that. Because look, I mean, if I'm a person or an individual or a being, right, there's where I end and there's the external world begins. You know, there's a boundary. And there's this boundary. But God cannot have boundaries. Well, but no, say he's not a person, simply to say, another way of saying, he has no boundaries.
You're saying he has no, you're limiting him also.
Yeah, we have already made that argument, actually. But you have to explain how this doesn't limit him. That's because it's Krishna inside the boundary and it's Krishna outside the boundary too. He's on both sides of the boundary, really. He's on this side in one form, in the form of his personal existence, Supreme Personality of Godhead, on this side of the boundary, in the form of his energies. And let me just say here, go on, we can go on. We see this in the Brahma Samhita, right? Ananta Rupa. What does that mean?
Next argument or same argument?
The same argument.
Unlimited.
Yeah, unlimited. Well, this is singular, actually. His form is unlimited. But I've seen it explained two different ways in Prabhupada's works. One is that he has unlimited forms. And the other way is that his form has unlimited energies. But otherwise, from a Mayavadi point of view, Ananta and Rupa is a contradiction in terms. As soon as you've got a Rupa, you've got an end. You've got an Anta. All rupas have antas, and this is an, you know, anta means end, so this is ananta, unlimited or unending form. Because this is a big argument, that person is a limitation, being is a limitation, individual is a limitation. So we say no, as Rohini said, if you deny these things, you've limited him. We've already given that argument. You say he's not a person, isn't that a limitation? And then you explain how this isn't a limitation either, because he's on both sides of the boundaries. He's his own environment. And it's a fact that there is nothing but Krishna. We got him coming and going. Right? Okay? Yeah?
Basically, this is a
Achincha Beta Beta Tattva. Yeah, Achincha Beta Beta Tattva. Right. He's on both sides of the boundaries. That's Achincha Beta Beta Tattva. Nothing is different from Krishna, but Krishna is different from everything. Yeah, Achincha Beta Beta Tattva. That's the answer to that limitation. So that has two parts. One, that to say he doesn't have a form, etc., and is not an individual, is to limit him. And then to say you can be an individual without any limitations by virtue of Achincha Beta Beta Tattva. Then the last arguments are one that we've just gone through. The one argument against the notion of this is dealing with the limitations of language. Our language cannot describe God. So our answer is that language comes from God, right? We take the premise that language is a human invention. I found the quotation from Bhagavatam. I meant to give you on that one. This is from Canto 6. They're playing marbles. Canto 6, Chapter 16, the purport, Text 32. Prabhupada says... 6, 16, 32. This is the purport. All the letters of the alphabet, he says, and the words constructed by those letters are meant for offering prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right, so that's where he says it there. Mm-hmm. What's the first letter of the alphabet?
Aksharam.
What is it? I don't know. Aksharam? What that means? Yeah?
Isn't that fallacious argument used by Maharaj Pariksit to Sri Goswami at the canon? It's summarized. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what the whole prayers personified Vedas is about. That's right. That's what that's all about, because the Vedas are glorifying Krishna. I am the letter A. Yeah, Akara. Oh, Akara. What is it?
Aksharana means the letters.
Among the letters, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, within the sutra, it's described.
Ikshite na ashabdam.
The Lord is not indescribable.
Right, by words, right.
You may not be able to describe
it
completely, but you can describe
it. Yeah, yeah. Also, in the purport to the next verse, Prabhupada says, one cannot offer prayers to the Lord with mundane words. Which means that if you're offering prayers to Krishna, they're no longer mundane. Okay, so that's that argument. And then again, another One is the one that I had used, you know, the argument from the superiority of bhakti to karma and jnana, that progressive argument, which is fairly sophisticated, you won't get to use on all occasions. But it's a good one to keep in mind anyway, at least for your own understanding of things. And then we have another argument, which I gave yesterday and before, that the basis of religious unity can only be Mayavad philosophy. That the basis of the unity or harmony of religions can only be Mayavad philosophy. In other words, that the idea of it's devotional traditions, because they worship particular gods, that causes interreligious harmony and interreligious strife and rivalry. And that if everybody became Mayavad, it would be peaceful. So we have an answer to that also, which is in that final paper I wrote toward the end. Okay, any questions about these? That's my list so far. If you can think of any other arguments Prabhupada has that I haven't included, well. Their last argument is that Mayavad philosophy is the basis for religious harmony, because religious conflict comes because people worship different gods, or the same God under different names. Some are worshiping Allah, some are worshiping Krishna, some are worshiping Jehovah, some are worshiping Durga, some are worshiping Kali, some are worshiping the Great Mother, some are worshiping, you know. I can't remember some more names. What's that voodoo guy? Baron somebody? I forget. Samadhi. Baron Samadhi or something? Who comes from South America? Anyone here? Anyway, you know, everybody they got their different gods. So we realize that actually it's all one, and these are just different manifestations of the same, then there's interreligious harmony. So anyway, I got into it yesterday. But actually that simply achieves harmony by relegating everything to illusion. It's really only a theoretical solution, actually. And that if you understand bhakti and the idea that the Lord can sustain wide varieties of relationships, and He appears differently in those relationships, and He manifests Himself according to time, place, and circumstance, then you can also have interreligious harmony and tolerance from the point of view of bhakti, and you do a better job of it. Anyway, that's that argument. Lola? You say everything comes from God. Yes, I can. I say everything comes from God. Language too. He's the creator. And then they'll say, well, you know, English was invented, so and so. Yes, but the original language is Sanskrit. Comes from God. And we want to talk about the language we're using to describe Krishna. We say this is revealed. They say, well, I don't accept that revelation. And we say, you know. First of all, you can start very specifically. When I say Krishna, Krishna playing his flute, this is all revealed. We say, no, it comes from Krishna. It's Veda. Veda means knowledge. It's apurusha. You just state the position flat out, you know. And they say, you know, I don't accept it. And you just have to say, well, that is due to a poor fund of knowledge. Actually, everyone accepts. All the great thinkers, sages, and authorities, they accept this. You just haven't heard it. It's the first you've heard about it. You hear about the Vedas before today?
No.
Well, then how can you reject? You haven't even listened. You know, so you start. You start talking about that. This language, Bhagavad Gita, this comes from Krishna. It's apurusheya. It's free from the defects coming from the transcendental platform. And then you can make an extension that actually all language comes from Krishna. Okay? Yeah?
Just an interesting something you noticed the other day. In the Bible, it states that originally the Word was one, and the Word was with God. That sort of indicates that language is already there.
Yeah.
The
Gospel according to John, in the beginning was the Word. Actually, in Greek, the Word is, the Gospels are originally written in Greek. Huh? In the beginning was the Logos. In Arche, hino Logos. Arche means origin. In the origin, in the beginning. Arche, like archaeology, hierarchy, you know, Arche. In the beginning was the Word, Logos. This Word, in Greek, means reason, speech, discourse, all these things. And it became a Stoic philosophical term, the world reason. There was a world logos, like this, you know, the world reason and the world soul. That idea of a world soul is in the Stoic philosophy. So this was floating around when John wrote that gospel. In Greek. And so he took this term and said, this logos, in the beginning, this logos, because the Stoics just had a logos, that's all. You know, it was just kind of the logos. But this logos was God, and it was with God. And then he says, of course, and then this logos was made flesh and dwelt among us as Jesus Christ. And that's why he takes Jesus Christ and relates something. It's a great job of preaching. You know, here's the term that everybody was all familiar with, kind of understood the general idea. A number of years ago in America, I guess this was in the maybe early 70s, maybe 73, 74, a book appeared called The Origin of Johnny. And it was a sex education book for young children. And it immediately created a big controversy because it had explicit pictures in it. Not photographs, but drawings. Because it starts with a little boy named Johnny wanting to know, where did I come from? You know? And so then it has the whole thing, you know, the sperm and the egg and, you know, pictures and everything. And at the end it gets down to the sex act, which has Johnny watching his older sister and her boyfriend, and then shows the sister and the boyfriend having sex. I mean, you know, right out there. So it was a controversial book. But the way the book begins, and by the way, it has a foreword by this guy, Crick or Watson, one of the two, you know, discover the helix spiral. And it actually starts at the beginning of the universe. And there's a whole system, before it gets to the sperm and the egg, it takes you through evolution and chemical evolution, you know, right back to the Big Bang. And the first sentence of this book, it's far out. I'll have to write it on the board. The first sentence of the book is, period. Next sentence, so, etc. In the beginning was the, and then there's a blank. We expect to see the word, word. There's just a blank space on the page. You know? And then it says, this blank was indescribable, unknowable, you know, and so on. And then it goes and talks about the, you know, how it expands and gluons or quarks or whatever they are appear, you know, and so on. And you get the whole, you know, Big Bang Theory. But that's how it begins. They take this deliberate parody of the Gospel of John, and where the Gospel of John says word, they have this blank, this void, you know, this emptiness. And of course it ends with copulation. That's right, it's really a demonic book, you know. I couldn't believe it, you know. I saw it in the bookstore and I said, well, let's see what it's all about. And I opened the first page, which is much more shocking than the last pages, you know. When I saw that they were done. Yeah.
This is why Prabhupada writes the first purport, the first Bhagavatam verse, that is due to the impersonalist idea of God, that there's so much emphasis on sexual.
Yeah, sure it is.
Like
sure. Yeah. It's called caused by lust alone. Yeah. The reason this impersonal idea does this is when you describe the spiritual world as being without form, name, qualities, then the material world, by contrast, starts to look actually more attractive. And second of all, the impersonalist idea means that really, you have to completely negate your senses in order to achieve transcendence. And because most people can't do that, you know, they always fall back down again. And they're always trying to find some way to make their sense gratification God. You know, they get into this loop between, you know, karma and jnana all the time. Sex is God too, you know. That's what they always say. When I was a new devotee and I was servicing our accounts at the head shop, you know, somebody offered me some ice cream. And I said, no, I can't eat it. And they said, ice cream's God too. That's what they said. You know? Yeah.
In the first section of the course, we were discussing the arguments against Sankara's philosophy.
Yeah.
How there's like no connection between God and the world.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
a lot of them do, but that's a little more of a specialized argument. Because what you see is when you have and I guess we could mention that as the next one, that you see in a lot of these places, they come down to it. It makes the Mayavada philosophy makes the world unreal. Because the impersonal one has no relationships. And therefore, really, it can't exist in the same ontology, in the same system with anything else. There's nothing else beside it. So the only way to affirm that is to eliminate all of creation. So therefore, God has no energies. That's their doctrine. There's no energies to the absolute. That means you make an absolute separation between God and the world. So they claim that their philosophy is non-dualistic, but the effect is of total dualism. Because we saw how they separate. How do you get from here to there? Well, you don't. There's no relationship. There's no causal relationship. There's no ontological relationship. There's no psychological relationship. There's no relationship at all. So the jnanis, just like the karmis, they separate the world from God. They don't see the world as everything as belonging to God. The karmis don't see everything as belonging to God. They see it as belonging to them. And the jnanis don't see everything as belonging to God. They see it as not existing whatsoever. So both of them see separation. That separation is called Maya. To see anything as separate from God is called Maya. So they're also in Maya when they say the world is separate from God. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a practical argument. that if you're actually going to follow this Mayavadi philosophy out, actually, you should, just like the argument used against yogis, first thing is, leave the city.
Well, I have a place in the country.
Go to a sacred place. You know. Do like that. You know, like first the thing, vow of celibacy right off the bat. And also actually to be a Mayavadi, the same, very similar requirements. You want to see what the rules are for a Shankaracharya monk. You'll find they're very, very, very stringent. But they can't. They're practical failures, you know, in this idea. And therefore, they keep returning to sense gratification over and over again. So if you just do this, you know. I mean, I guess that's the way I got into Krishna consciousness, was not first philosophically being convinced, but just being, realizing I was not able to control my senses, and then somebody said, well, that's because your senses need spiritual engagement. Why don't you try chanting Hare Krishna? So I tried chanting Hare Krishna without realizing by engaging in the act, I had implicitly accepted a whole philosophy about God, the relationship of God in the world. I mean, it's all in there. Just in the act of chanting Hare Krishna, you've accepted all that implicitly. And then I just began to realize when I couldn't give it up without feeling suicidal, because I tried. You know, because what happened is my desires went away so quickly I became really frightened. You know, I thought I'm in the grip of something very, very heavy and I'm not even sure what it is. You know, and it was just too scary. Plus, I didn't know what to do with myself. Because I didn't know the devotees very well, and I didn't know how to be engaged at all. So I quit chanting to see what would happen, you know, and it was hell. I could only stand it for about a week and a half or so before I started chanting again. You know? So sometimes that happens too. But it's there if you actually accept the activity of chanting Hare Krishna, then you've accepted that your senses can have transcendental engagement. And that's completely counter to every tenet of Mayavad philosophy. Of course, the Mayavadis chant too. That's a fact. So they can begin the chanting without accepting the philosophy. But actually what's implied, the idea that you have, the senses have spiritual engagement, is that. Because that's the thing about Mayavad, when it makes the Lord impersonal, that means absolutely inaccessible by the normal activities of life. You have to put yourself in an artificial and unnatural position of being senseless, nonsense, inactive. And therefore it doesn't work. You know, that's why Shankaracharya propagated it. It increases the temperature of spiritual life. And people are becoming nihilists anyway. Which is another form of void philosophy. It just means you don't believe there's anything out there, but you're attached to this world, you know. The Buddhists believe there's nothing out there, but it's better than what's here. Yeah? Yeah, they refer to absolute chance.
So it's not preconditions.
Absolute chance means, because a lot of times if you introduce chance into a system, another way you can deal with it is by saying, well, there are other laws operating that we don't know yet. And these random intrusions are actually due to the operation of unknown factors. But they deny that. They say it's absolute chance. It occurs in the so-called reduction of the wave packet in quantum mechanics. Schrödinger's equation calls for something called the reduction of the wave packet. Because the way the mathematics works out... Because of the way the mathematics works out, you would have in your visual experience incompatible things. There's a whole example of a catch, a cat in a box, that mathematically is both simultaneously alive and dead by the quantum mechanics. But the experience is it's one or the other. So they say that the wave packet becomes reduced, and this reduction is just completely at random, and there's no underlying cause or anything. So this is the introduction of absolute chance. That's on the most fundamental level. Then, of course, it shows up again in Darwinian evolution, where it's chance mutations that cause things to species to develop. Yeah.
How could you have chance? Like it must be like a conditional chance, say for evolution, because it's all the forms are like continuing a certain sort of relationship with the preceding one.
No, but they're what they want to say is there's small little random variations that take place, you know, and something is born with a little bitty tiny difference, and that difference gives it a survival value, and so that difference, you know, keeps going. That's what they want to say. But it's because of these little minute variations, chance variations, in genetic makeup. Sometimes they have a cause, it's cosmic rays or things like that, but actually they're just variations that just happen for no reason.
So chance is only a very, very small aspect of all the order.
Yeah, but it's the one that really allows for order to develop out of disorder. Now even so it can't happen, you know, and I think Sadhguru has shown very well. That you just the amount of time for such a thing to happen, just, you know, is not there. But anyway, that's what they want to base it on. How do you get something from nothing? That's the whole idea. How do you get something from nothing? And this nothing is not even a big egg like Plotinus's one, you know? This nothing is really a nothing, you know? It's not even nothing with a capital N. Yeah. Yeah? No, that's probability. I think that refers to probability. Anyway, I'm out of my depth in this stuff, you know. Anything has numbers in it I can't handle. But that's to talk about probability.
I thought it was really an absolute chance.
No, not as far as I know. Anyway, that's all I can say. Yeah.
So, the Christian and Islamic doctrine of ex nihilo.
Yeah. Well, I guess they at least refer to the inscrutable power of God. The interesting thing is, by the way, is that the descriptions of ex nihilo, if you actually sit down and listen to a Christian really describe or try to get into an explanation of creation ex nihilo, it starts to sound just like emanation. Anytime they get into it, you know, and he says, this is what I mean by ex nihilo. He says, well, that's what we mean by everything emanating from God. As soon as you try to explain creation ex nihilo in any cogent way, you lose the idea. You really do. I mean, you know, I could show you some accounts like Thomas Aquinas' account of creation ex nihilo, and you'd say, well, that's not ex nihilo. What's happened to the from nothing? You know, he creates it by his energies. You know, it's like, and so on. And the doctrine of Shakti Parinamavada, I mean, it's close enough. But they don't want to believe that the world is eternal. We don't say the world is eternal, but the energies out of which the world is composed, that's eternal. And that's Krishna's eternal energy. But the creation ex nihilo, What it is to me that doctrine is the reflection of a psychological condition of alienation. from God. And God becomes, you know, it's like Otto called him, you know, the holy other. Ganz anderes, you know, the completely, he's you know, an alien being. He's completely different from ourselves. Or Karl Barth, that fundamental, you know, God is so, you know, he's out there, he's inscrutable, we can't understand him. All we can do is follow his laws. He does things for his own reasons. You know, we can't know what he's doing. Some people he's damned from all eternity, and some people he's saved from all eternity, and we can't understand it. See, that's what they're dealing with. Like some of these Protestants, you know, with the Presbyterian types, that some have been damned for all eternity. God knows everything. So some are saved and some are damned. So that means they're damned before they were born. They're created damned. Predestination, you know? And that's why you have to say, well, you know, there's God. He's some kind of like monster, practically speaking. But he's God. You have to submit to him. You have to surrender to him. He's God. You can't think he's a monster. So you have to say he's just like totally, utterly, 100% incomprehensible, inscrutable. And we just surrender, you know. You should talk to some of these people sometimes, you know. Evangelical Presbyterians. They come around to the temple every so often. They had a course at this Presbyterian seminary in Philadelphia called Elenthics. You ever see that word? That's what I first said. I said, what's the name of the course? Elenthics. E-L-E-N-T-E-L-E-N. Something like that. Elenthics. I looked it up. Science of Refutation. So they had a course. So they were sent to us to defeat a Hare Krishna, you know. And they write a paper about it. And the first year they came all prepared to defeat Mayavad philosophy because they knew we were Hindus, you know. So that really flipped them around, you know. So we didn't see him for a few years. Then they came back, you know. And then they'd send us their papers after they finished refuting our philosophy. And their refutation was that we didn't accept Jesus Christ in our hearts as our personal saviors, you know. That was the refutation. It was a little lame. But, you know, I used to question them about, you know, because they were Presbyterians. And the Presbyterians, the ones with this, you know, Dutch Calvinists and Presbyterians with this notion of predestination. It actually traces back to St. Augustine. The seeds of it are there anyway. And that's what it is, you know. You're damned. They insist on it, you know. Some are saved, some are damned. You don't know which you're in. And God does this. It doesn't make any sense. It's completely illogical. Seems to be totally unjust, but he's God. You know? Inscrutable. You know, and in their philosophy, you know, there's the world and there's God and there's a gap. And, you know. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I asked him, you know, I can see why you still want to worship God. Just because you worship God and, you know, damned or saved, he's God and you should worship him. I can understand that. But why are you trying to get anybody else to worship him, you know? You're not going to save anyone.
How do they swallow it?
I don't know. You know, they're weird people. Well, you know, this is what the Protestant ethic that Max Weber says. They were in such anxiety over their fate. They wanted some sign. They wanted some sign. Because Max Weber, the German sociologist, said that capitalism came out of this group of Protestants. These group of rich Protestant merchants and things like that developed capitalism, the rational organization of formerly free labor. And he said, and capitalism means you that these people were personally very austere people. You know, they didn't smoke, they didn't drink, they didn't go to dances, but they accumulated vast amounts of wealth, huge amounts of wealth. And capitalism is a machinery for just making more and more money, more than you can ever spend. And these people were not big enjoyers. They were ascetic people. And he said, why? And he says, he traced it back to this the Protestant ethic, you know, among these Calvinist types, who needed, you know, out of their psychological insecurity, some proof, some evidence that they were saved, looking for something. And it says in the Bible that among those as God has favored, He's poured out His blessings. So to them, this accumulation of wealth was some sign that they had achieved the blessings of God. So it was out of this incredible anxiety about the fate of their souls that, you know, this machinery was developed for creating, you know, more and more and more wealth called capitalism. Anyway, it's controversial, but that's the famous Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism.
Still has that today. In fact, we met the secretary of Jimmy Baker in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah.
The Boston Sanctuary Court, Mario. He was telling us how much part of their philosophy that is that God is actually favoring Jimmy Baker.
That's right.
And so you should actually give him more money.
That's right.
That's testimony that he's
That's right. Okay, so the examination tomorrow, a 1-hour essay. Lois, you're the prophet.